From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. On the show today, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and why their problems could affect all of us and our children.
After emergency meetings over the weekend, the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve announced plans to provide more cash for the two housing finance companies if they need it. Fannie and Freddie have suffered major losses in the mortgage foreclosure crisis.
Federal regulators are hoping the latest moves will help prevent a further decline in the company's stock prices. So far today, those stocks haven't moved much. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Fannie and Freddie's stock prices got hammered last week as investors worried about the stability of the two companies that are behind nearly half the mortgage debt in this country. So the Federal Reserve will grant Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac access to its so-called discount window. That will give the companies access to additional loans until Congress can act. The Treasury is asking Congress to pass legislation that could grant hundreds of billions of dollars in credit in the longer term. The Treasury plan would also give the government the option to buy a stake in the companies if that's what's needed to keep the mortgage companies in business. And the Treasury is asking Congress to give what it called a consultative role to the Federal Reserve in new regulations developed for the two companies. The Senate Banking Committee will hold a hearing on the proposal on Tuesday. This is the second time that the Fed has stepped into the mortgage crisis since the government helped bail out the investment bank of Bear Stearns earlier this year. Both moves raise concerns that U.S. taxpayers could bear some of the costs if the government's rescue plans don't work. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
New York Times business columnist Gretchen Morgenson is here again to help us sort through the ins and outs of this. Let's just get to the basics. These companies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, what exactly do they do and how are they different from companies in the private sector?
Well, they're quasi-government, quasi-private entities, and that's where the confusion arises. They are not actual lenders like a bank, but what they do is they raise debt from, the capital markets, and then they buy mortgages. And they either hold them on their own books or package them up into securitization pools and sell them to investors. Now, when they do that, they guarantee the mortgages. They are on the hook not only for losses that arise in the mortgages that they carry on their own books, but also for those that they have guaranteed when they sold them to other investors.
Now, are they in trouble much in the same way as other mortgage lenders got in trouble? They basically backed bad debt, bad loans?
That's right. We are worried now that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have not really recognized or told investors about the extent of the losses that they may see or that they have already seen on their books. And because these entities are so enormous, I mean, we are talking about $5.2 trillion in mortgages that they either back or own. It dwarfs every other mortgage company that has failed or had problems.
So is it true then that the government basically has no choice but to enter into this and to help out Fannie and Freddie?
Really doesn't have any choice. Furthermore, a lot of investors by way of mutual funds, money market funds, own Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac paper because it was always perceived as having an implicit government guarantee. But it is very dispiriting because the taxpayer once again is on the hook.
Does that mean that the taxpayers will be buying these bad loans?
That's essentially what it means. As these things fail, if there is no way for the companies to raise money elsewhere, for instance, from private investors, maybe from sovereign wealth funds, overseas investors, if they can't raise the money that they need to, you know, offset these losses, essentially, then the government is going to have to back them. And the government is you and me and my son and my son's children, and that's what's upsetting about it.
Now, there's an article, an analysis piece in your paper today, not written by you, but by someone else, who basically says that there seem to be two lines of thought in terms of how Fannie and Freddie got into this problem in the first place. Liberals say, well, there wasn't enough government regulation or oversight. Conservatives say, because they were or are a quasi-government organization, that they basically weren't playing fair in the market and playing by the market rules and got into trouble that way.
Well, I would say that it's sort of a combination of both. They should have been much more cautious, in my view, of what they bought and the mortgages that they financed. Now, they did have a regulator. The regulator was extremely weak. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were extremely powerful and aggressive lobbying organizations as well. So they could keep this nice little arrangement that they had where the government was sort of implicitly backing them. It really was kind of the worst combination of privatizing profits, i.e. the company's shareholders and the company's executives made a lot of money when the thing was going well. But when the thing goes kerflooey, then it's the taxpayers who end up footing the bill. And that is not the way capitalism is supposed to work.
Well, we've seen a similar thing happen to Bear Stearns that almost collapsed. Countrywide in serious trouble, was bought out by Bank of America. IndyMac just taken over the weekend. How many other financial institutions are in trouble?
Well, I think that most banks are unfortunately in a similar circumstances. It is hard for me to say who's, you know, the worst off and who's better off. But we had a lending spree that was unprecedented where anything goes. You know, you had people who were not, had no income documentation, no asset documentation, no job verification, were given loans. And it was all about generating the fees on those loans to the companies who made them. Now, the costs of this really mania that generated so many millions of dollars for so many people in these private sector companies is now coming a cropper.
Gretchen, how does this compare to the savings and loan debacle, which cost taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars?
Well, it's far larger, and it is far more complex. In the savings and loan disaster of the early 90s, late 80s, you were really mostly talking about commercial real estate and multifamily homes. And those were much easier to take over and analyze, you know, whether the financial statements or the cash flows that were generated by the rents in those buildings were adequate to meet the borrowings that they had taken on. We are now talking about single-family homes. This is not something that you can work out en masse or in large swaths like you could in the savings and loan crisis. So it's far more complicated.
So it sounds a lot more frightening, actually, to be frank about it. How scared should we be?
This is really one of the most nettlesome and enormous problems that I think we have had to face. There's just plenty of blame to go around, but I think that we have to face the failings and really admit them and then try to set up practices and policies that will make sure that that won't happen again.
New York Times business columnist Gretchen Morgenson, thank you very much.
Anytime.
We're joined by one of the people who's supposed to sort this out. Congressman Barney Frank, a Massachusetts Democrat, is chair of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, welcome. What are you going to do?
I expect that the House will, this week, take the essence of the proposals that the Treasury Department with the Federal Reserve's participation has made and add them to the pending housing bill. We have a very important housing bill, which will also have the improved regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and send it to the Senate, and I think they'll pass it and send it to the President by the end of the week.
What about risk to taxpayers here? Isn't that something people are a little concerned about, exposing taxpayers to huge obligations?
The problem is that the markets, I think, have reacted excessively about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the damage to taxpayers, to the economy, would be much greater if we didn't do anything.
Congressman, you said, if I may, you said earlier, people are more afraid of this situation than they should be. But the stock market is absolutely rocked by this. People lucky enough to still have any money don't know where to put it. How bad are things, and what are you saying to the American people about how they should look at this?
They should look at things in their fundamentals. Look, the market over time is a reasonable measure of value. On any given day, it can be subject to hysteria. And I guess implicit what you're saying is, well, the stock market knows best. No, it doesn't always know best. Now, what we are saying is the federal government will now say to people, look, don't have these excessive fears about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for two reasons. One, in the short term, we will advance money, but we don't think it's really needed. And we are correcting the conditions that led to this problem. And that's very important. In this same bill that we're dealing with, we're going to have the Federal Housing Administration get back to the role it used to have of being the place where people go for mortgages. Under the Bush administration, it dwindled. The Federal Housing Administration doesn't give these bogus mortgages. It doesn't give you mortgages without knowing how much money you make. We're also going to be improving the regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So what we're saying to people is, look, things are not as bad as people thought, and the market seems now to be understanding that. We are taking very concrete steps to make it less likely that these kind of crises will occur, because you're not going to see these kind of subprime mortgages infecting the economy.
We just heard from Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times. She says much of the blame for the mess here goes to negligent regulators. Wouldn't that include the House Financial Services Committee?
No. I have to say, when you come with preconceptions, as you appear to do, you don't always get the analysis right. In 1994, Congress passed, the last time the Democrats were in power, the Homeowners Equity Protection Act. It gave the Federal Reserve the authority to ban many of the mortgages that led to the problems. Unfortunately, when the Republicans were resistant to doing some of this, and it was the ideology of the deregulators that was the problem, but Greenspan had the authority. If Greenspan had done 10 years ago what Bernanke is doing today, you would not have had as much of a problem. Secondly, with regard to the House Financial Services Committee, in April of 2007, several months after I became the chairman, the House passed the bill that just passed the Senate yesterday to increase the regulatory powers over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So we also passed a bill last year to improve the ability of the FHA to offer alternative mortgages. So we have been trying to do this. Now, there have been some problems with the Senate, with the general inability of the Senate to act these days on things. But this has been a problem, as I said, of the conservative philosophy of never regulate.
The chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts. Congressman, I stand corrected on your committee, and thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick.
Al, you've been away for so long, it's felt like centuries. We've started a summer series, and it's called California Dreaming. Our blog is called Daydreaming. Isn't that catchy?
Yes, very good. Okay.
We've been looking at the faltering economy by examining how it's affecting the California dream. And, you know, many people think of California as this great place to escape the East Coast, the cold.
It is.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. Oh, you did that. And settle down in a sprawling ranch-style home in the burbs. But Californians are defaulting on their home loans, are spending hundreds of dollars filling up their gas tanks.
Yeah, still, it is the place of innovation and even optimism still, isn't it?
It is. And today on California Dreaming, we are profiling an innovator and optimist. He goes by the name of Mr. Jalopy. Here's how he describes himself: mediocre welder, fair mechanic, and clumsy designer.
That could be a lot of us.
From his workshop in Los Angeles, right off Interstate 5, Mr. Jalopy is helping lead what's called the makers movement. It's a trend that may transform the way we use the things we buy. NPR's Celeste Headlee has more.
Mr. Jalopy's garage is lined with cabinets filled with parts, an unimaginable number of widgets, wires, and springs, all carefully labeled and stored in case he needs them to fix a garage sale purchase. Over here is a station wagon that he's tricked out with Christmas lights, and here is a polished wooden cabinet that he transformed into an MP3 player.
I wanted to listen to a Dinah Washington song that I knew that I had on an album, and I thought, why should I keep buying the same music over and over every time a new format comes out?
So he took a beautiful Art Deco radio, circa 1940 or so, fitted it with an iPod and an LCD panel from an old computer monitor, and then rewired the whole thing so he could transfer his music from LPs to MP3s.
I've taken a portable iPod, made a giant iPod, eliminates all that mugging risk that they were talking about early on.
I see the rest of Hoopty Rides, Inc.
Nearby is what he calls his urban guerrilla movie theater. It's a sturdy wooden box mounted on a Schwinn adult tricycle.
Instead of bemoaning the end of the drive-in movie theater in Southern California, I decided to make my own drive-in movie theater so that I can enjoy it with my friends.
His theater travels anywhere and projects movies onto a 12-foot screen. Mr. Jalopy is a maker, a combination artist, tinkerer, and craftsman who's inspired by what he finds at garage sales. Artist Nemo Gould is stirred by his discoveries at the San Francisco dump.
Everything you've got in your home I've seen at the dump in any state of repair imaginable, perhaps sealed in a box and brand new.
Gould is a kinetic sculptor that makes robots and shiny, sleek scooters out of discarded objects. He's also a maker, and both he and Jalopy are part of the growing makers movement in California. Dale Doherty says it starts with simple questions.
What could I do with my first generation digital camera, or second generation digital camera, or my first iPod? I mean, they're lying in a closet somewhere. I could do something interesting with them. That it's part of the assets we have at hand. Why not use them somehow?
And he says that leads to learning how to reuse and reimagine objects you already own. Doherty is the editor of Make magazine.
On a very simple level, I think the maker movement is sort of identifying yourself by the things that you make, and that could be dinner.
But on a more complicated level, the makers movement is about more than creating cool rockets or braided rugs. It's also a philosophical idea about what ownership really means. Mr. Jalopy defined this with a maker's bill of rights that he wrote in 2005 when he tried to replace the batteries in his iPod and found the case glued shut.
If you're not able to open and replace the batteries in your iPod or replace the fuel sender switch on your Chevy truck, you don't really own it. The terms of ownership are still dictated by the company that assembled it and glued the iPod shut so that you couldn't get into it.
The list of 17 directives includes, if it snaps shut, it shall snap open, and ease of repair shall be a design ideal, not an afterthought. Nemo Gould says he wants to return to the days of the 1950s, when people kept things for years and didn't toss them out when they broke.
A lot of average suburban men would have a metal lathe in their garage. That's something that you can't even conceive of today. But it was sort of common, oh, well, if my lawnmower breaks, I'll want to fix it, won't I?
Although the makers movement started with a few techno geeks, artists, and hobbyists, it's attracted thousands of people who never considered themselves handy. Bay Area-based Make magazine has a circulation of 110,000, and a record 65,000 people waited in two-hour traffic jams to get to the Makers Fair just outside San Francisco.
There's a paradigm shift definitely occurring, but these are not paradigm shifts that have never occurred in society.
Joseph Lopez works at the ACT Lab at the University of Texas, where their entire purpose is to make stuff.
You know, in third world countries, they do this all the time. You know, they have cars and they can't just go get the part from AutoZone. They have to just be creative and make it. And there's a whole culture behind making parts for your car that don't belong in your car.
And while the maker's mentality is spreading to mechanics in the U.S., Mr. Jalopy's philosophy has caught the attention of some major corporations. Jalopy has consulted with Disney, Apple, and others, preaching the gospel of open source manufacturing. He tells them to use screws instead of glue to make schematics readily available. For technology companies, create forums for consumers to share ideas. For car companies, sell patterns so people can make car seat covers. He says it's about changing with the times.
You have to be ready for when your competition does open the doors and does start engaging with consumers in the way that they want to do business, because they're going to, and then you're going to have to figure out how to catch up.
Jalopy says when a company engages with consumers, they get passionate advocates of their products, true believers that will give them free publicity and increase sales with very little effort. He says it's worked beautifully for Apple's iPod.
I'm sure there are other MP3 players out there, but who even knows what they are? Nobody even cares, because the true believers have made the iPod the brand that it is.
And many of those true believers are driving the makers movement. Mr. Jalopy says there's a real sense of satisfaction when you've made something yourself, when you've had an active hand in repairing, adapting, or transforming a broken egg timer into something useful.
And these objects that are out there at garage sales waiting for you right now, this Saturday, get up at 7 o'clock, go out there and start looking for these objects, have already lived these incredible lives with people, these inspired objects that have caught sparks of the owners that had them.
Jalopy says in the end, the makers movement isn't so much about what you may find at someone's yard sale as it is about becoming resourceful and developing a stronger relationship with the things that you own. Celeste Headlee, NPR News.
As the name suggests, Mr. Jalopy, he loves old cars, and one of his favorites is an old yellow Camaro he's called Sister Golden Hair Surprise. Well, last week we asked you to send us a picture of your car and to tell us what it says about you. Go to our blog and check yourself out. You can also see Sister Golden Hair Surprise there. She's a beaut.
NPR.org/daydreaming. This is what you've been doing?
More to come on Day to Day.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. In a few minutes, traveling with nomads in drought-stricken Somaliland.
First, the stocks of the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac seem to be holding ground today, thanks to action by the Federal Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Bank to protect them from failure. Congress is expected to ratify those actions in the next week or so and add them to a housing bill that's been pending for months. Joining us, NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hello again, Ron. And does this mean Congress finally gets its housing bill done? President Bush, for his part today, chided Congress for taking so long to respond to this crisis.
You know, Alex, we've been in this mortgage-driven credit crunch financial panic, if you want to call it that, for almost a year now. It really dates back to late July of last year. And we've had ups and downs. We've had the market come back. We've had the market go back down. That is to say, the overall market, the stock market, and so on. But now, finally, it appears that the Freddie and Fannie crisis, where you have literally a couple of outfits that have a piece of about half of all the mortgages in the entire country. And when you've got them teetering, that's really going to focus everybody's mind. I think Congress is finally going to get this thing done. It's been almost a year. I think they're going to get the bill out in the next 2 weeks.
We had the chair of the House Financial Services Committee on a little earlier, Bernie Frank, Massachusetts. He says, you know, the problem here lies with failures within the Bush administration. They had tools. They didn't use them. Is that the take that, say, neutral analysts would make?
I think you can raise the criticism that regulation is not what the Bush administration likes to do. It's not their first option to say, what can we do to tell the markets how to behave? Now, Barney Frank likes to say that the markets are rational in the long term, but they do have moments of hysteria. And that's where the regulators would like to step in where they're absolutely needed to keep things from going off the rails. The Bush administration's philosophy has always been that the least amount of regulation within the rules is the best way to make the markets robust and help them grow the economy, make it all a more healthy entity.
Congressman Frank corrected me in the course of this interview. He said, you know, my House committee passed regulatory legislation in April of last year, shortly after Democrats regained control of Congress, but it's gone nowhere in the Senate because we can't get anything done in the Senate. How's that sound to you?
Well, that is certainly true that Barney Frank's committee did pass legislation shortly after his becoming the chairman, and it didn't go anyplace immediately in the Senate. That's frequently the case. The House and the Senate are as much enemies in many instances as the Republicans and the Democrats, liberals and conservatives. They're two different institutions, and they tend to have their own sense of prerogative about who should be making policy. Beyond that, in the Senate, you need 60 votes to get anything significant done. There are really only 49 Democrats and 49 Republicans with two independents. So there is no clear preponderance of party power in the Senate, and that often has the Senate in irons. It can't go either direction.
But it does sound now, you think, as though this is finally going to get done with this latest panic, if that's not too big a word, over these mortgage companies providing the final push. And what is at stake here, do you think, for the individual legislators?
That is why I think it will get done, because what is at stake for the individual legislators at this point is their reelection in November. In the House, all 435 have to stand for reelection or retire. In the Senate, you've got about a third of the seats up, and a lot of people are worried about their reelection, and they see gas prices raising the ire of the electorate. And now, on top of that, you're going to threaten their houses. You're going to threaten not only people's ability to use their cars, but their ability to stay in their homes. No, I think at this juncture they are finally going to put aside their House, Senate, left-right problems and get something done. Question is if they can get something done that President Bush will sign or that they can override the president on.
You mentioned gas prices. President Bush today, and I think this is still involved in all this what about our money thing. President Bush today is lifting the longstanding executive ban on offshore oil drilling. So what's going to happen there?
Nothing. The president's executive ban on offshore oil drilling is not what's keeping people from drilling. It's the legislative oil ban, the one that's in law. Congress has to change that. The president can't do it unilaterally. It's just a way to put the pressure on Congress and say, I've done everything I could do. How about those guys?
NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, keeping an eye on everything there in the nation's capital. Ron, thank you again.
Thank you, Alex.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. More now on financial institutions in trouble. The California bank IndyMac reopened today, but now it's run by the feds. Customers lined up this morning to take their money out of IndyMac. It is the second largest U.S. financial institution ever to fail. There could be more to come. Marketplace's Amy Scott is here now. And Amy, let's talk about IndyMac first. What went wrong?
A lot. IndyMac is one of those lenders that made a lot of loans with lax underwriting standards and lost money when those loans went bad. The bank also relied heavily on selling its loans to investors in the form of mortgage-backed bonds. And as the market for those securities dried up, IndyMac took a big hit. So on Friday afternoon, after customers had raced to withdraw more than $1 billion in just 11 days, regulators stepped in to take over. And today the bank reopened as IndyMac Federal Bank. Regulators will now try to find a buyer.
And, Amy, this is the sixth bank failure so far this year, so that's practically one a month. Who's next?
Analysts are trying to figure that out. Bank regulators actually keep a list of troubled banks, though they don't make it public. And there are some 90 institutions on that list right now, though apparently IndyMac wasn't on it. I spoke earlier with Aaron Fine. He's a consultant to the banking industry with Oliver Wyman Financial Services. Fine says there are some 8,000 financial institutions in this country, and many of them were lending in similar ways.
So you look across all those institutions, and I think you have to expect that there will be some more failures. Now, how big those institutions are, I think, is a question mark. But I think certainly we will probably see more failures before it's done.
Well, Amy, IndyMac certainly was a big one. What happens to customers when a bank that size goes under?
Well, if you have an account worth up to $100,000, it's automatically insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. So those customers have nothing to worry about. They get their money back. But regulators say some 10,000 depositors at IndyMac exceeded that limit. Another consultant I spoke to told me those people could get maybe 50 to 75 cents on the dollar back. And all told, the FDIC estimates the IndyMac takeover could cost between $4 and $8 billion.
So customers are actually losing money on this. Does the FDIC have enough funds to cover all the losses?
The FDIC says yes. I mean, they aren't expecting anything like the bank failures of the late 80s and early 90s when well over 1,000 insured institutions closed. Predictions now range from dozens in the next few years to maybe a few hundred. And if need be, the FDIC will raise more money from the insurance fees it charges financial institutions.
Thank you, Amy. That's Amy Scott of Public Radio's Daily Business Show Marketplace. This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. The prosecutor of the International Court of Justice in The Hague has filed formal charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and murder against the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. The prosecutor said that the genocide in Darfur is ongoing, that 2.5 million people have been forced from their homes, and in his words, quote, we don't have to wait until those 2.5 million die before doing something. This is the first time that this court has charged a sitting head of state, but what happens now is not clear. Juan Mendez is president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. He's a leading world human rights advocate. Mr. Mendez, welcome to Day to Day. What does happen now?
The pretrial chamber, which is a panel of the International Criminal Court of three judges, will review the initial submission by the prosecutor and decide whether there's enough grounds there to merit an arrest warrant and an indictment of Mr. Bashir. The regime is definitely gearing up to resist and to condition its other cooperation with the international community on a variety of other things on quashing this attempt by the prosecutor to bring Mr. Bashir to account.
In the event that the court said, yes, this is the correct position for the International Criminal Court to take, we should prosecute this person, is there any way to actually arrest a head of state?
There isn't, but the whole International Criminal Court is premised on the cooperation of states with its findings. The prosecutor doesn't have a police force that he can rely on. It all depends on the international community's decision to back up this institution.
The Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, has today said, I'm worried that the UN personnel who are in Sudan now could be put in danger by this move. What about that?
I think he's right to be worried. I think if anything happens to them, it will not be the responsibility of the prosecutor. It will be the responsibility of Mr. Bashir and of the Sudanese regime. And it's very important for the international community not to allow itself to be blackmailed by a regime that is resisting a decision of an international judicial body.
Mr. Mendez, you have been a human rights activist for decades now, and a leading one on the world stage. I wonder how you view this development now, because the president of Sudan, Mr. al-Bashir, has essentially said, I'm going to ignore this. What difference is it going to make?
I always thought that prosecuting crimes is an integral element to the whole thing that the international community has to do to solve the Darfur crisis. Obviously, it's not the only one. What Bashir is doing is basically saying, if I'm indicted, the international community can forget about humanitarian assistance, can forget about deploying an effective protection force, and can forget even about a peace process. That's the kind of blackmail that the international community just cannot accept.
Juan Mendez, president of the International Center for Transitional Justice, on the indictment today by the International Criminal Court of the president of Sudan on charges of genocide and murder. Mr. Mendez, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chadwick.
Near Sudan, African nomads say a prolonged drought is making life unbearable there. Most of the nomads are camel, goat, and cattle herders who now wander the vast arid territory for days, weeks, sometimes months, searching for grazing land and water. Emily Meehan sent us this report from Somaliland, and this is an area that has broken away from Somalia.
On the road out of Somaliland's capital, Hargeisa, signs of a drought are all around. Refugee huts have sprouted around gas stations in the past year. Many of the new transplants are pastoralists who left the countryside after their animals died. The traditional livelihood of Somali people has always been nomadic pastoralism. Now the people in these makeshift tents live hand to mouth, selling tea or food to passers-by. Farah Mohammed is cooking stew for two customers in the blazing heat.
My animals could not get grass or water because of the drought, and so they all died.
Her family had 20 camels and 50 sheep. Now the mother of eight says she can hardly earn a living. Paved road ends at the city's edge, and we drive on sand past small villages and herds of animals. Amina Mohammed Jibril is an older woman in a bright pink shawl with a dozen cows. The skin on their backs is stretched thin over their bones, which jut out sharply. She'll keep walking until she finds grazing land.
We have not had rain in almost a month. Earlier, animals had some grass to eat, but now they don't have anything.
In the next village, animals gather round a rare well. From every direction, nomads approach. A grizzled old man with a herd of camels shouts that he's suffering. Mohammed Abdi Elmi says he's been traveling for 7 months to find water and grass.
We haven't been able to find enough water to bathe. Day and night, we were persuading, but by now we are dried out completely.
Somaliland traditionally has two rainy seasons, spring and fall. In fall, pastoralists would head for the coast, where rain was always expected, and in spring they would head for the border of Ethiopia. But this year, both rains failed. At Wadi Makahail, near Somaliland's southern border with Ethiopia, 33 pastoral families from the same clan live in camps. The clan chief and local government administrator, Ismail Musa Kahin, says the drought here is in its second year. The government brings water in trucks to those who can afford it.
People can't afford to buy more water. they can't even buy food because prices have risen, and since their animals are too skinny, no one is going to buy them. They have lost their livelihood.
First thing in the morning, nomads renew their search for water and grazing land. 18-year-old Mustafa Omar Abdullahi says he's been walking for 2 months since leaving home and has never been this far south in his country.
Since the rainy season is nearly finished, we are worried that our animals might die.
Back in Hargeisa, the country's only meteorologist is employed as Director General of the Ministry of Education. Ali Abdi Odoa blames global climate change for extreme new weather. Hargeisa has gotten hotter, he says, and during the rainy seasons, they have either hail or drought.
So in the Somali line, I think for the last, 15 years, 20 years, rainfall gets minimized every after year.
He says the government can't afford to build weather monitoring infrastructure that could warn pastoralists of seasonal changes. Somaliland's Minister of Finance explains that without recognition from the international community, his breakaway state gets almost no investment from outside and no bilateral aid. 50% of Somaliland's meager budget goes to its soldiers. They were trained as young guerrilla fighters during Somalia's civil war, and the government fears the men would revert to factional warfare without employment. Somaliland's biggest source of revenue is livestock exports to Saudi Arabia. At the lively Hargeisa animal market, skinny camels, cows, goats, and sheep are being sold by pastoralists. Middlemen say they're getting lower prices because the animals are thin. Mohammed Ibrahim Awed sold his animals this week.
Each animal has lost half of its value. The drought affected the market value of camels, sheep, and cattle.
Rain has now come to Hargeisa, and in this Muslim country, God is held ultimately accountable. Banks can be heard during afternoon thunderstorms. For NPR News, I'm Emily Meehan in Hargeisa.
Back now with Day to Day. 6 weeks ago, Farouk Al-Zuman became the first person from Saudi Arabia to climb Mount Everest. The climber says he wants to encourage young people to follow their dreams just as he did. Carol Murphy reports.
Zuman's path to Everest was first set when his dad got him into sports as a toddler. He swam, learned Taekwondo, and played soccer. But it was only when Zuman moved to the Northwest U.S. to go to college that he fell in love with climbing mountains.
I was in the United States for a long time, actually, on the West Coast, especially in Oregon and Washington. So a lot of mountains were around me in that environment. It was like surrounded by all these mountains, so it was just beautiful to climb and see it.
Zuman hiked up Mount Shasta and Mount Rainier, and he was taking in a spectacular sunrise on top of Hawaii's Mount Haleakala when he got the idea of tackling Everest. After graduating from the University of Oregon in 2007, he looked for an expedition company with a good safety record. Then he began looking for money. His middle-class parents are civil servants and have four other children. They supported their son's quest, but couldn't afford the $30,000-plus it would cost. In the end, the PR firm where Zuman works and a Saudi fast food company picked up the tab. At 11 p.m., on the cloudless night of May 20th, under a full moon, Zuman set out with his Sherpa guide for the final push up Everest. 16 hours later, they reached the summit.
I was breathless, like how the clouds look like. I just love clouds. Just seeing that the mountains, like how they came through the clouds. These mountains are huge, like 7,000 peak and 7,050. And I see them just from up there, and I know that I'm on the point, which is like the top of the world, the whole universe.
30-year-old Zuman said he felt more proud for his country than himself.
An international sport like that where we've never been in, it's like, yes, we did it, as you know, the Saudis. It's like more that I was thinking about my people more than about me being the first. It wasn't like a really a big goal for me to be like the first Saudi, more than it's like, you know, raise the flag, you know, and represent.
Like many Saudis, Zuman is devoted to his religion, and he makes a practice of reciting the Muslim call to prayer whenever he reaches the top of a mountain.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Creation of God, like trees, animals, would hear that too. In my mind, it's like the higher I go, the more like creations of God that will hear actually the prayer. And that will be a witness for me in the Day of Judgment, and also will get me like even closer to Allah.
Back in Riyadh, Zuman was hailed as a national hero. Now, he says he wants to use his accomplishment to inspire other young Saudis, not just to dream, but to make those dreams happen.
The main thing for now is that trying to motivate people that everyone got their own little or huge peak, whether it's Everest or not, you know, and this is life. And taking the first step, you know, taking the initiative and start, you know. And we have a saying in Arabic that we say, like, you know, it's probably in English too. You will finish 100 miles with one step if you start.
For NPR, I'm Carol Murphy in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Okay, to Alaska now, where there's an orchestra unlike any other in the world. It's made up of a group of women who perform music at mostly an amateur level, and yet they sell out every one of their concerts. They also happen to live together in one big house. From Alaska Public Radio, David Shurtleff reports.
Inside an old auditorium north of Anchorage, 11 women are tuning and warming up. In just an hour, this empty room will be packed with a large and uniquely appreciative audience. Viola player Sarah Jane Kaufman explains.
You know they're comfortable with us, and that's really cool. You don't get that weird vibe from them like, ugh, these criminals.
Yeah, she said criminals, as in felons or prisoners. And that's because all of the musicians in the orchestra are inmates inside Highland Mountain Correctional Facility. Like Sarah, the women tend to be middle-aged and unexpectedly pretty, people you'd be more likely to find at a PTA meeting than a penitentiary. But all of them have been convicted of serious crimes, ranging from drug possession to murder. The only requirement to join is serving a long enough sentence to learn how to play. Patty Crowfoot created the program and runs a nonprofit called Arts on the Edge to fund it.
Stringed instruments are really hard. We were out of pitch for a good year.
And sometimes they still are. But the struggle with scale, staffs, and sonatas is only a fraction of the problem. When Crowfoot first started the orchestra 5 years ago, challenges included everything from collecting donated instruments to getting the prison superintendent to let them ditch their prisoner-issued yellow uniforms for their live shows.
The first concert was in June in Alaska, which, you know, in June in Alaska, the sun is up most of the time. And it was really funny because when he was contemplating the black outfits, he said, I don't know, I think it's against prison regulations because they could kind of like steal away into the night. And I said, Dean, it's June, the sun's not going to go down. And he says, okay, you can get the black outfits.
And there have been other times that prison rules have slowed down the orchestra. Like the time that two key musicians nearly missed a show because they were in solitary confinement. But despite everything that can and does go wrong, the prison orchestra appears to be teaching some valuable lessons. Take viola player Jackie Bennett, for example. She's scheduled to be released later this summer after serving a 5-year sentence.
You've got to be able to come together. Teamwork. I mean, those are all skills that you're going to need wherever you go. You know, and you learn them in orchestra. I've learned so much from it besides just playing an instrument and just being blessed with that.
And that's exactly what creator Patty Crowfoot had in mind when she started the orchestra.
A lot of the gals have told me it's the one time in the week where they forget that they're incarcerated. We're just a group of friends that play music together.
And for the next hour, they are the Highland Mountain Correctional Orchestra. Playing today's concert to a room packed full of fellow inmates, there are simply 11 women dressed in concert black, performing for a sea of prison yellow. For NPR News, I'm David Shurtleff in Anchorage.
Day-to-Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Chadwick.